It took some ownership. It took me saying, I'm a writer, and having that mantra and living up to it.
Welcome to The Confident Healer. I'm your host, Sharmila Mali. And in this podcast, we have inspirational, uplifting, and soulful conversations about the ins and outs of having confidence as a healer and as a healer in business. This week's episode is a little bit of a different twist in terms of the type of healer that I usually have on the show, although her energy is naturally very healing, as you'll soon find out. Remember that substitute teacher that was mostly assigned to your school? Someone who was just so awesome, someone you could really relate to and you just loved? Well, that's exactly who my next guest is, figuratively and literally. One of her many jobs is as a substitute teacher and a soon-to-be published author of her new novel called Despite the Buzz, which is slated to release on Mother's Day of 2021. We talk about how writing is healing and how it led her to get her book published. She teaches us that even though you may not know it at the time, everything you do has a purpose, and each person you meet has a meaningful impact on you. She also learned she had to prioritize herself, which wasn't always easy as a wife of a firefighter and a mother of two children under the age of 10, especially during a pandemic. This novel journey of hers, which took her, quote unquote, 4 long years to write, is a beautiful testament to self-love and self-care. You see, self-love is also asking for help, tending to your dreams in addition to all your responsibilities that you have in life. Let's peek into the life of an author with Tamara Miller Davis, this week's Confident Healer. Hello and welcome back to The Confident Healer. I'm your hostess, Sharmila Mali. And today we have an ever so bright and lovely soul. She is my friend, a fellow dancer, a US Coast Guard veteran from Michigan, a Californian substitute teacher, and a soon to be published author of Despite the Buzz, which is a fictionalized tale about technology's toll. It's a human interest story with heart, a sociological study of modern times pre-pandemic. The novel centers around a motivated character named Miss Oliver, who raises awareness about screen use inside her reflective writing class. The book depicts demands upon school teachers providing understanding to those who grew up before and after current technology. But when an intimate act is shared between students over social media, an inciting incident demonstrates that the potential in our pockets could be lethal. And by the way, my remarkable friend and guest is a happily married fire wife with two kids. She volunteers for her children's school and was able to squeeze in time to write and professionally edit her new novel over the past 4 years. With a big hug, let's welcome Tamara Miller Davis.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
Yeah, so glad to have you here. Thank you, thank you, thank you. So, you know, you said you wrote this book over the past 4 years, and I think you spent the last year editing, and then the pandemic hit. So what was that like?
Well,
with kids at home and...
Yeah, anytime that I took a hiatus from writing, I'd have to reintegrate, refamiliarize myself with the story. Thankfully, I had a timeline that I hand wrote out and a character profile for each character. So that helped, and just rereading, getting back into the thought process behind it, the intentions, the goals, and all of that took time. But I was thankful for my husband's willingness to give me that space and that opportunity to move the project forward, because the pandemic was so depressing in so many ways, mm-hmm. you know, and this project gave me something to feel good about, to feel proud about, and to just keep moving forward, even though the world was on hold in other ways.
Right. I'm just curious, like, how you Like, do you have a big white, I'm just like the process. Do you have a big whiteboard with where you're at in the novel and where you were editing and what you wanted to rewrite in the midst of getting kids ready for school and, you know, just life in general? Like, how did that?
I have 1,000 checklists and folders with different criteria. I have my to-do folder, my research folder, my characters folder, my publication folder, all of these different hats that I'm wearing as an authorpreneur and a creative person. So yeah, it took a lot of juggling. And when my kids were home on virtual learning, it was hard to do it all well, to be honest. And I have high standards for myself. I'm an A student, so to speak. I don't want to say type A because that has a stigma attached to it. But when I say A student, it means when I sign up for something, I want to do well at that, at it. And that comes from the work ethic, I think, that my parents taught me. And my husband has it as well. And so when I was at home with the kids, I wanted to be a super mom, but I also really personally wanted to attend to this project. So to juggle both was hard. I had to carve out time. And sometimes that time was late at night when my husband was home and he would put the kids to bed, and it was a trade-off. And sometimes I felt bad about that because I'd miss, you know, reading before bed with the kids and whatnot, but they'd bring me down dinner and stuff. I have a writing studio that's on the lower level. It has a separate entrance. So, you know, we'd stay connected, but I had to permit myself that time because this is something I've always wanted to do.
As hard as it was, it sounded like you still were able to prioritize and not let that the guilt of parenting, you know, take you away to take you too far away from it, and just finding time to squeeze that in. And I'm just wondering, like, did that, how was your confidence during that period last year?
It was hard because it was hard to plan even one day ahead, you know, in the pandemic related world, pandemic influenced world, as everybody knows. It was hard to plan ahead. So when the school that my kids go to first went to remote learning, it asked a lot of parents. And during that time, I didn't really work on my project because I was all in as a stay-at-home mom / substitute. I have subbed over Zoom a few times for a different school. And I was just nurturing my kids and making sure they got the work done and being accountable to their teachers and trying to support the teachers with ideas and, you know, have a healthy relationship there. And during that time, I didn't do much for myself. But then in the summer, what happened is, so when school ended, my husband said, okay, why don't you pretend you're on a retreat type thing and you can live, so to speak, downstairs. And we did that for like 3 weeks. I didn't sleep down there, but he took time off of work and I acted like I was on a writing retreat, and that allowed me to get the next draft to the editor. So it enabled me to do the things that I felt were necessary to get it to the next step.
Wow. That was, well, I didn't know that. That's really amazing to have such a great and understanding partner. You know,
because
you know, we're in Southern California and it's fire season too, you know, for a long time, cause it's so dry. So that's just amazing that he could take time off from his, what he loves to do and support you. So before we dive into the book, I'm just wondering, like, you know, what the confidence it takes to write, and then the decision to publish a book. Like, what, where did that confidence come from in you?
It's been a journey, and I wasn't always so ready to put my work out there. So this is a big step.
Wow, nice.
Yeah, I've always been a writer. I have a huge bin full of journals. So I've written many books, but nobody's read them. I've published articles and done some things that have been looked at. But as far as a project this big, it was a huge venture. And it took some ownership. Mm. It took me saying, I'm a writer, and having that mantra and living up to it.
Mm.
With respect for the writers that do it well, you know, and trying to live up to that title.
Mm. And so what about this? Because you said you have a few books you've written, but no one's seen them. What made this, despite the buzz, what made you want to pursue to publish it?
I think it has merit. It's timely. And I did have some support from other creatives early on who I consulted with, and they saw it as worthy too, and either contributed to it or said some things that encouraged me. And that was good for me to have that validation. So I just kept growing it. I just kept giving the story a chance. And that's what it took.
Wow.
To believe in the story and myself. It's worth noting that I didn't feel as confident back when I worked in the very masculine Coast Guard. And at least not during my first 2 years in the service.
Hmm.
I mean, even though it was a worthwhile and exciting experience, it paid for college and it took me to California, which is where I met my husband, Sean. It wasn't an exact fit for me. Not as a lifelong career, anyway.
Mm.
I craved intellectualism, roots, and family nearby. But now, 20 years later, it feels like I'm right where I'm supposed to be. A place where I feel supported, loved, and recognized as a woman.
Yeah, yeah. Because it's such a, I mean, it was, you know, some people take, I mean, it took you years to, you know, to do this, to write this. And yeah, that's where, you know, that's why I do this podcast, just to try to understand, you know, where that the motivation comes from to keep you going when it's such a process to write. And, you know, it's a heavily researched book, and you're doing that research. And then it's not like, you know, you're single, you know, you have a life, you have a full life with children and husbands and lots of volunteering, and then your own passions of, you know, dancing. Cause I remember, you know, you texting everyone like, oh, I can't come to dance cause I gotta focus on writing. I was like, right on, right on. Pun intended.
Good one. Yeah. Dance is empowering, even though, you know, I have to decide sometimes, should I go to dance class or should I stay home and write? It has its own creative juice, as you know, and being around a group of women like that, who make time for their ambitions and honor each other's, that's been really supportive for me.
Hmm. Yeah, that's, you know, that's kind of something surprising to learn since I've embarked on this project of this podcast, is learning about the communal aspect of confidence, of building. And I never put that together until I started talking to other people about it, about having a community. And sometimes it's, I mean, you know, this is a dance community, and then I guess you have your writing community, but like all that is a lot of energy to like fuel you to, I guess, keep you motivated, keep you on point. Because I feel like, I don't know, for me, sometimes there's just days I'm like, I don't know, you know, if I've been working on something, like, oh God, I don't know, you know, it's just kind of hard to find the grit to say that, okay, I'm going to keep doing this. So yeah. Is that something, and what do you have a process to kind of, despite, I mean, and with all your checklists, I guess that's one way, but do you have are there other ways besides community support and support of your family, and to keep that inner, to keep your passion stoked to move forward and to believe in yourself?
Mm-hmm. Listening to inspiring podcasts like Elizabeth Gilbert's Magic Lessons. I like that one. And just engaging with good literature, self-help type inspirational books, and other great works of art. That keeps me going. It feeds me. And also just doing my work feeds me. You know, when I was down in the studio for those 3 weeks on a writing retreat, I lost like 3 pounds, 3 to 5 pounds or something. And it's because writing feeds me. I don't even really feel hungry. It's like really nourishing. So I feel like it's my calling, and hopefully I've done a good job with it. I've definitely given it my best, and it's a work of heart. And I realize it won't be loved by all, but I'm pretty confident it'll be liked by many.
I'm sure it will, because it's such a timely, important look at, you know, children and social media. And so what inspired you to write despite the buzz?
Well, the climactic scene, which I won't give away, was one of the original inspirations. And that came years before I even started nailing it down to a story. And it was kind of a what if. Oh my gosh, what if this happened? And it's in relation to current and unfortunate news. And when you read the story, you'll understand. But the what if was an inspiration. And then also teaching. So I've been a substitute teacher for about 12 years. And I went through the credential program. I did my student teaching. And I've been at a private school with my own kids. They go on scholarship. And public schools is where I studied and have subbed. And then I've had a routine gig at a charter school too. So I've seen the spectrum, at least here locally. And I've seen what has happened with technology in schools. And the kids, especially in high school, are so distracted by their cell phones, as we all are at times. But we have to prioritize presence and being present when learning and communicating and being in relationships and so on. And it's hard because I feel technology's dead too. So I get it. I'm not like above it. I'm in it, man. And I'm commenting on it at the same time from this meta perspective. As a teacher who's been in classes and seen it firsthand, where kids, you know, have something down in their lap. Right. It's like, okay, you're not listening. Will you please participate? Type of a thing. And it's hard when you don't have backing from the school admin to enforce any kind of cell phone policy. And it's different for every school, and I respect that. Schools have different missions, and I think there are many ways in which people learn, and schools can be creative with that. And I don't want to overstep myself and, you know, trying to like suggest policy or whatever. I'm just a witness and an observer and an interpreter of research. And I've read a lot about mental health, mental wellness in relationship to technology and specifically teenagers. So that's where I'm coming from, particularly Sherry Turkle's book, Alone Together, which I quote with permission in my own novel. That one really struck me. There's a documentary called Screenagers, and I recommend that to all parents. It's about this woman who is a mom and a physician and an author and a filmmaker, and her daughter wanted a cell phone. So she documents the process of what happened within their family, good and bad. She's just really mindful about it. So I appreciate her work. And then also Dr. Jean Twenge, she's written a number of articles, and she has a book called iGen. And so her work is integrated into the novel as well, as far as thinking points for students and readers alike.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. I was just going to ask you what all goes into writing a book, because I always, you know, you kind of take for granted when you're reading a work of fiction, and but there's a lot of research that goes into it to make it, to make parts of it real.
Mm-hmm.
So like how much, so did the research, did so some, you sparked, the idea was sparked and then you started doing research, or like how did that, how was that creative process for you?
Yeah, it's recursive. One informs the other for sure.
Mm.
So I would be reading something and then taking notes on it and wanting to do something with those notes. And then I'd have ideas for the book and it would all sort of integrate, but I could keep going with that forever. And I finally decided, Tammy, you have to cut yourself off and you just have to use what you have and make it work, because I could keep writing and maybe I will write a sequel or, you know, network with people and continue on this process. But as far as the book goes, I think my research is mostly complete for what's inside of it, I hope.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm just curious, like, you know, like how much that voice is like, okay, stop here, because there's so many, you know, places you can go, I'm sure, when you, once you mm-hmm. have some research and then you think about like a character and you can just like go off on a tangent. So how do you, like, besides, do you have an outside source, like other, you know, writers to help you like corral some of the ideas and where you want to go with it? Or like where, if you've just started writing something, it's like, well, oh God, I have like 40 pages here about this one thing. Like, how does that work?
Yeah. Just self-checking. And also mm-hmm. I had an editor and she read the book 3 times for pay. I hired her to developmentally edit it. And that was for narration, perspective, characters, plot, everything you'd expect, story arc, hook, and so on. And she gave me good feedback and things to think on. And I reworked it. And then I wanted to go back to her. I wanted her to see it again and see what she thought. So that round of editing was minimal, but she got to read the changes that I implemented. And then, you know, she suggested a few other things. And then when I felt like I was getting really close to handing it off to the designer, I had her copy edit it. So that's looking for typos and, you know, punctuation, the nitty gritty. And most authors who get backed by big publishers, well, probably all authors who do have that service done, but not all indie authors do.
Mm-hmm.
But I was willing to pay for that because I wanted to give my work a chance and I wanted to be and look professional. And I want to treat my readers to something mm-hmm. that's easy to read as far as, you know, the grammatical construction and so on. And I don't want there to be more typos than there needs to be. Although I'm sure there are some stray ones still in there, but, you know, I gave it my best.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm just wondering, like, because I know for me, so I, when you're trying to shop around for like a, you know, to publish your book or publish an article, you know, you have to submit, and you know that part always would scare me in terms of like submitting articles, or it would scare me because I'm just like, oh, the rejection. And, you know, like, how was that? Like, how do you prepare yourself when you're looking for a publisher mm-hmm. mentally to, you know, like, here's my baby, I've been working on for 4 years, like, please publish this, it's so good, it's so timely, it's, you know, like,
mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I'll speak to the editorial piece first. I met Naomi, who is the founder of the Artful Editing Company, at a writing conference, and I wrote her number down and such. So I reached out to her and she matched me with an editor, just knowing the basic summary of my book. Now, it turns out that the person she matched me with is from Michigan.
Oh.
And we hit it off, and she's been very supportive, not overly critical. And so that worked. As far as pitching, so I could send her my drafts without too much fear, because right. once we created that rapport, I kind of expected, you know, some decent feedback and everything with constructive criticism as well. But pitching to agents who represent you to publishers is a different story. And I did go through that. Last summer, I had Isha, our dance teachers, help with the website, and I got myself in gear so that, you know, I had this package to submit to agents. And that's called a query process. So my editor and her boss, Naomi, helped me wordsmith what's called a query letter and a synopsis. And they helped me come up with a list of, I think it was 18 agents, specific to genre, specific to interests. And I pitched each one thoughtfully by doing my homework on that agent to see what they're interested in and who they represent and that kind of a thing. And it took time and it took wordsmithing and courage. Mm. And I either didn't hear back or got a polite no thank you from all of them, which is normal for a new author.
Right. Yeah.
And I could have kept going with that. I could have pitched to more than 18, but as you know, this is episode 18. That's my lucky number. And it's also the classroom number on the teacher's room in the story. And it's my birthday. And so I said, you know what? I tried for 18. And by happenstance, I had a conversation with our dance friend, Carolyn, who said, you know, I've been meaning to tell you about my husband. He has this indie publishing business and he's a graphic designer and all of this. And I about fell over. It was like, oh my gosh, this conversation was meant to be. And I'm so glad that I took the indie route because I get to keep some creative control. I'll make more with each copy sold. And I get to learn about the process. I can go to Dave's office and, you know, he'll say something and I'll say, what does that mean? And so forth, because he's designing the interior now and he's already designed the cover. So I get to see, you know, right there in front of me what's happening some of the time. And that's so cool. And I'm glad I got to go through the query process and pitch to the big leagues and then decide to come home to the home team, you know?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And you're getting it published, which is amazing. And I guess my next question is like how much, like, you know, it's, you know, you put, you know, like you said, 18 is the classroom, like how much of it, because, you know, a lot of it is kind of, you know, kind of, there's some of your influence in it being a teacher, you know, English was your major. So like how much of you is in the book? I mean, you're writing it, but sometimes, you know, characters take on a life of its own. Is there a particular character that you identify with that you kind of modeled after yourself, or just, are there pieces of you in every character? Like,
there are pieces of me in different characters. Mm-hmm. The main character does resemble me, but she is not me. And I anticipate that people will ask that question, so I'll say it now. We would be friends probably if she were real, but she doesn't have kids. She looks a little different from me. She has a different background. She has some different habits and so forth. So we are not the same person, but we have some of the same values. Hmm. Say it that way. Yeah. So it's a third person narration with a limited view of everybody but her. So it's omniscient to her. And that was recommended by my editor. And I do that carefully through using italics for her thought processes.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm. So the narration is specific to her. So I can't see through the other people's eyes. And that was something that was figured out kind of in the middle of my process on how to go about that. I can comment on what other people see if it's apparent to her.
Right. Interesting. Yeah, that's quite interesting because I'm not familiar with that process because I've never thought about writing a fiction book, because that's just, I mean, like, hats off to people who do, because it's fun for you. I don't know if that would be fun for, you know, I mean, that's why you're drawn to write those characters and to be so like thoughtful about, like, okay, who the perspective is. And, you know, you always hear this, find your voice. So, like, is this book your voice? Have you, you've mentioned before, you have many unpublished books. Is this your voice that we're hearing?
Well, those unpublished books are mostly journals. So that's definitely my voice. That's introspective and reflective. And I've done mostly autobiographical essays.
Mm.
So this was a different experiment in doing the third person thing. And this book has contributions from other characters, from their firsthand point of view. So they submit journal entries. It's in a reflective writing class.
Oh, okay.
and letters. So that I had to take on their point of view. And that was tricky. I had to keep it consistent and I would hear it. It's kind of like music. I hear how that character perceives the world and how they would interpret it and relay it and apply it to whatever's happening in the class. Mm. So oftentimes I would have an idea and I'd have to ask myself, okay, Tammy, you want to use that idea? Who would say it and who would argue it? So I had to incorporate both because there's this dialogue between the students in the class. And to get the idea from the article or the research or whatever and put it in the story, somebody has to say it.
Right.
And that has to be congruent with whoever they are.
In a teenage voice.
That's right.
Because they're all teenagers. So, like, that's what is interesting, because, you know, your children aren't teenagers and you've taught teenagers. So how do you, what kind of research or does that come natural to you to create these, you know, characters that are, you know, I mean, you were a teenager yourself, but does that come into play? Like, how do their voices, where do their voices come from? I guess that's what I'm trying to say.
Okay. So yeah, my credential is 6-12 English, and I've had a reoccurring gig at a high school, and my student teaching was there. And I've always been kind of a field observer, a person who's always taking notes mentally and through journaling on people and the human experience and conditions and so forth that really interest me, like the sociological thinking behind things, how society is working. And some kids really stuck out to me through student teaching and subbing, and they have stuck with me. And their voices, the students I've known, have influenced my writing. Mm. I've also taught ESL for, I think, 9 summers at the local private school where my kids go, and working with international students and day campers who are just, you know, local kids, and seeing all that take place every summer definitely played into things too. And then the charter school where I've worked the longest and have done long-term assignments there, seeing those students and just the variety of kids in our county. So, yeah.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, I'm just always curious because we've talked about this before. So I just want to get this. This is not particularly a young adult novel. It's more for adults.
That's right. Correct? It's to be up front, it's a coming of age story for the teacher.
Mm.
And not all of the characters are teenagers. It is set in her classroom, but she has a romantic relationship. So that guy's a character. And she has a mentor, a teaching mentor. So that woman's a character. And then there are other adults who come into play, like her father. And I should mention that she writes letters to her deceased mom. Mm. So that adds a timeless piece to it and a nostalgia. Her mom died when she was 5 years old of cancer. And her mom's name is Rose, in honor of the late author Amy Krauss Rosenthal, who also died of cancer in 2017. She's an acclaimed author that my daughter and I both appreciate. And when I found out that she died, I was halfway through reading her newest book, Textbook. And I had already read Encyclopedia of an Ordinary Life. And I was devastated that she passed. And she was such a creative person. She wrote an article in the New York Times Modern Love section about her husband and finding a match for him after she was gone, as she was on her way out. And I thought, wow, to be thinking ahead, you're on your way out like that for your loved ones. That was huge, you know? And I sort of used that in the book. So the main character's mom left her daughter an inheritance of journals.
Mm.
And the daughter responds to them through writing letters to her mom. And those are in the book. So there's a multi-generational feel to it, where the mom's life is alluded to and hinted at, and the daughter is living in current times.
Mm.
So, and then I should also say that the main character's name is Gabriella Oliver, and her last name is Oliver because she's also named in honor of somebody who died of cancer in 2016, a woman that I worked with at summer camp. And we had kids together at camp, and we had recess duty together, and we were both teaching ESL, and she found this lump in her arm. And I remember that day because we had recess duty together. And, you know, we weren't best friends, and we're not even the same ethnicity, and we didn't hang out outside of work, but we connected that summer. She didn't come back the next year. And it really affected me because I felt like we were on a similar track with our kids and our teaching and so forth, but she didn't get to continue her track. And I named the main character after her.
Wow.
Slightly different spelling of the last name. My character's last name is Oliver, which people might relate to Mary Oliver, who recently died, the renowned poet. And my favorite poem of hers is Wild Geese, which has to do with going beyond the bad and the good and just seeing what is, which is something that Eckhart Tolle talks about too, not really weighing things as good or bad. And that comes up in the story. So there's this inciting incident that you mentioned. And it gets at the notion of villain, vigilante. Are things, people, choices necessarily good or bad? Or are they just relative to circumstance?
Yeah, it's why impact, were you two the same age? Is that why it was so impactful to name, to memorialize her in the book?
Yeah, I wanted to honor both of those women. The late author that I mentioned, Amy Krauss Rosenthal. And she was from the Chicago area, just like my main character and her mother are. And then my coworker, we are we were similarly aged. And her daughter at camp there was about the same age as my son. And we would get our students together for karaoke and so forth. And it's just like when she found that lump, you know, you didn't know what would happen from there, but I didn't expect that she'd die and not come back the following summer.
Yeah.
Because with summer camp, there's this cohort of teachers who tend to return every year, and you're all in, man, for summer camp. You go to the preliminary meetings, and then you do it, and you're all in for those 6 weeks, and you're together and you share this experience, and it's really uplifting and awesome. And I'm so fortunate to have been a part of that for so many years. So to lose somebody, even though she wasn't there for the whole time and different years and everything, but to lose somebody from that cohort changes things. And there's a hole. So there's a hole there now.
Yeah. I mean, she made a big impact enough to be able to memorialize her. Have you reached out to her family to let her know, like, oh, this character is based on her?
I haven't. And I wouldn't say the whole character is based on her. But
when she's named after. She's named after her, yeah.
The namesake, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't really know her family.
Mm.
I mean, she and I connected, but I'm not sure if I'll follow through on that and how they would feel about it. And the same with Amy Cross-Rose and Fell's family, her daughter Paris. I've thought about reaching out to her because I believe she's carrying on her legacy. And I need to research more on that. But
yeah, it's just so beautiful just to know, you know, the mechanics of building a novel and putting it together and the influences and the inspiration and how impactful people can be and a bond that you share. I mean, I think, especially when you meet someone your own age and they have a few children, as well. So there's so much that you have in common with, and then to see them, you know, get stricken with a disease and then die from it. You know, I mean, it just kind of puts your own mortality at stake too. Like that could, you know, that could happen to any one of us, and to really, take stock of what you have in life, you know, instead of, because we all tend to focus on what we don't have in life, but the trick is to want what you have. I forgot where I read that, but I read that somewhere. That's the main trick, is to want what you already have. And it's just so fascinating when you talk to authors and their processes for creating the novel. And it's just such a beautiful testimony. And it says a lot about who you are as well, of wanting to honor and put their legacy in your own way. You know, I think that's really beautiful.
But yeah, that was part of the inspiration for her name. And also in the dedication of the book, it's dedicated to my kids, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
To thoughtful teachers who are out there doing their best, and to, I say, motherless children of all ages and families impacted by cancer.
Mm.
So that plays into my own family too, because my mom lost her mom when she was 18. When my mom was 18, her mom passed.
Mm.
And then both of my mom's sisters died young from heart disease. And my mom, as you might remember, is a heart transplant recipient.
That's right.
So I've been at death's door with my mom several times at the hospital. And that also impacted me. So those are the dedications. And then the other dedication is to brain injury survivors. I used to work at a brain injury support group /center. And I got to know the people who would come in. We would provide meals and services and speakers and community. to these survivors in Ventura County. And that was a great job. I was an administrative assistant, and I really appreciated the musical recall that several of the survivors had. And if they would forget my name, I would hum "Tammy's in Love" and they would remember my name. And it's like these people, you know, who were struggling and misunderstood and so forth could remember these songs.
Mm.
And that would jog their memories. And so I wanted to creatively work that into the story. And I do through a brain injury survivor. And that's part of the reason for the dedication there.
Yeah. I mean, so obviously this was like pre-planned to include the impact that you've had in your life, like with the working at the brain injury center. And why did you want to have a character with a brain injury? Why was that important to you?
One of the clients that I really connected with, her name was Memory.
Oh,
believe it or not. And I connected with her family, and I took a memoir writing class from her uncle when Memory mm-hmm. was still alive. And Memory also passed in recent years. Not from cancer as far as I know, but just an unforeseen death. And that's part of the reason, just my experience working with the brain injury survivors. And I suffered a head injury when I was 19. So I have that in hindsight.
Hmm.
That was it a term?
Was that a traumatic brain injury, or was it?
It was.
Mm-hmm. And how long did that because sometimes some people never recover from that. There's always, so how did that affect your life?
Yeah, I did recover from it, thankfully.
Wow.
And I'm glad to have had that experience in hindsight. That's a whole different story, and you'll have to wait for the memoir on that one. But okay. That played into me wanting to honor brain injury survivors and mm-hmm. the journeys that they're on for different reasons. You know, people right. have accidents with bikes and cars, and mine was with a four-wheeler, a quad. And some people have acquired brain injuries, like strokes,
mm-hmm.
And then traumatic brain injury. So at the center where I worked, there were both types there. And just really interesting people that I didn't want to discount because they were injured, so to speak. And that was meaningful for me. It was when I first started college. I worked there for a year. And that was another meant to be place in my life.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I'm still friends with some of those people that were affiliated with the group. So
it's interesting, you know, you don't quite put, you know, you model it after somebody else, but it's also, you know, adding not only that experience of your relationship with memory, but also your own brain injury and honoring yourself and how, you recovered and some people don't recover, but they still lead their lives as mm-hmm. fully as they can, you know? And, it just seems like there's just like this novel is so much more about like social media and teenagers. And I just want to say like, she wouldn't let me read it. I have to before it was published. So I was like, so I can talk about the book. So I don't know anything about it. That's why I'm you know, kind of delving in and so it's just, yeah, it's just, it just seems like now that we know, you know, who the main character is named after and some of the other characters and who they are and who they meant to you, it just seems like it's also honoring not only you as a writer and wanting to put this particular voice out, but also just honoring in your own way, the people that have really made such a big impact, have such a big heart. And
It's just, I think part of the reasoning behind the story too is, so I'm a Zennial. I'm on the cusp of being a millennial and Gen X as well. So people who are our age can remember a time before the internet dominated everything. And we're also living on the cusp of technology's cutting edge. So we have a unique viewpoint to reflect back on the way things were and to look forward to the future. And I'm not trying to berate technology in my book. Ultimately, the teacher embraces it and teaches digital citizenship. But that has to do with embracing modern times and living up to the challenge of being courteous to each other online and so forth. I will also say that the characters write letters to an unnamed president of the United States. So it's set in 2019, loosely, and they share their concerns, which are topical issues. I won't call them political issues because it's a human interest story. But they do share some concerns, which gives them a passionate and political voice. And it allows them to refine the language in communicating those things instead of just posting in brief, posting at large, posting without proofreading, and that bullshit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's, you know, allowing them to develop a polished voice, and it fostered character development. So these are distinct teenage voices, and their letters are written with that character in mind and what they care about and so on. So you really get to know the characters that way. And the original idea for that was, like, there was so much going on in the news that it was impacting me. And I wanted to sort of lightly incorporate that into the book because nowadays news is just at the forefront of everything. And I also needed an assignment. I mean, you can't have a story set in a high school classroom without some assignments going on.
Mm-hmm, right.
So I had to think up some assignments that had gravity and that had meaning and that would be timely, but not off-putting to people. And I mean, some of the students do have political leanings, but not too far, I wouldn't say. And you know, some people are going to like it. Some people won't love it, but right. I think it comes from a human-centric point of view. These kids are concerned about things that are regional. It's California, let's be honest. And just national and sometimes global.
Yeah.
So.
Absolutely.
Teenagers care. And I wanted to say that. I really wanted to say teenagers care because a lot of times people don't give teenagers the benefit of the doubt. And I was a passionate teenager. I was a student body president for 3 years and vice president for one. And I was on cheerleading for all 4 years. And I did the downhill ski club and I was all in to high school. Now, not everybody's all in. And some people don't really do school. They could care less about school and that's fine. I mean, different strokes for different folks, but I love school both as a teenager and a college student and a teacher. And I wanted to take what I knew, the raw data from my experience and use it for good. And I hope that this story will bring about awareness so that people make better choices online. Mm-hmm. And maybe it'll even help some people with mental wellness because they'll feel heard. These different characters in the book bring up different various points of view on social media, right? So I'm hoping that readers will be like, oh yeah, I felt that way too. Oh my God, yeah, that's me. I've had that same reaction to things happening online and so forth. So by lending that resonance to readers, I'm giving them gifts of relatability. Mm-hmm. I think that's what good books do. When you get out your highlighter or you fold over a page or you make a note in the margin, you've succeeded as an author with that reader. And Stephen King calls that telepathy. Mm-hmm. And the writer is having a conversation with his or her reader. There's this telepathy that's happening, regardless of time or space. And that's what's so cool about books, is that they can exist on the shelf beyond an author's lifetime.
Right.
Like we were talking about Mary Oliver and Amy Cross Rosenthal, and they're still impacting us. And that's so cool.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely.
I can't pretend to be that great, and I can only aspire to be a first-time author. That's where I'm at in my journey. But boy, I've really been influenced by great writers like Elizabeth Gilbert, Brené Brown. I already mentioned Sherry Turkle and just so many others.
And so, you know, journaling is very healing, and, you know, in the world of healing, you know, there's a lot of journal prompts in therapy processes and whatnot. And so is fiction writing a form of, can that be healing too? Because now that you've told me some of the journey of writing and, who these characters are named after. Like it just sounds like it was a very healing process to kind of, you know, give honoring the people that have impacted you.
Yeah, it's healing to kind of follow my calling, to give myself time for that. Because I'm really a believer and everybody that I love and wanting them to do well. Mm-hmm. And I've supported a lot of people through dance, through community, through family, friends. And I hope that people will support me on my creative journey and with my passion project, so to speak, because I've certainly done that for others. And this time it's like, okay, I'm doing something for myself, but it's also for others because I'm giving them a book that I've put my heart and soul into. And it may not be perfect, but man, I sure worked at it.
Yeah. Well, it's perfect for you and it'll be perfect for whomever reads the book. You know, we talked about this before the interview about how writing is healing and making time for yourself, especially as a parent with small children, younger children, because I think it might be a little bit different with older children, especially when they're younger and they're in the house, and to set aside time, because parents, especially women, don't put, you know, they put themselves last. And so that's why I was just like, wow, how did you find the time?
That's why it took me 4 years.
Well, that 4 years isn't a long time though. You know, I mean, sometimes some people is like, oh God, they work on it for 20 years and finally, you know, get to a point where they can, okay, now is my time to write. But just, yeah, I mean, that's something that I always talk about is carving time for yourself, because as women, we put ourselves last on the list.
Yeah.
And that comes up, it really shows up in your health, but we don't have to self-sacrifice, because you can still be there for others and also be there for yourself. And I think, you know, as you've always been a writer and then wanting to really put your work out in a bigger way and in a bigger container, I think that's just so important to stress that it wouldn't have been written if you didn't give yourself that time.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And I did start two other books. One was a memoir about my time in the Coast Guard. And the other one was fiction about a road trip. And I didn't follow through with those. The memoir I really wanted to, but it felt too close, too vulnerable. Mm. But it was still good. It was good writing practice. And that took some dedication. I followed that through for a while. I believe that was before kids though. So this was a totally different experience based on teaching, based on having kids, reading plenty of parenting books, taking parenting classes. And I applied all of that, my mom's mindset and my teaching experience and things I read to writing. So in that way, it is recursive and they informed each other, so to speak. But yeah, it was hard to break away from the family at times. And I had this counselor that I was meeting with that encouraged me. And I appreciated her giving me mantras and daily affirmations and such to own myself as a writer and to heed my calling, because I'd certainly done that for my husband as he worked his way up through the fire service. And I'd been really flexible with his fire service schedule. Well, yeah. And that takes its own toll, especially with childcare and not being able to predict who's doing the childcare and whatnot. I'm thankful for the support of my mother-in-law who lives nearby, of course, but that is its own challenge. So I was there for him so that he could follow his passion and do well and make a name for himself within his department. And now it's my turn.
Yes.
I've been receptive to that and generous, and I'm really thankful awesome. That we could support each other and complement each other.
That's what relationships are about, right? Ideally and practically. And that's such a great testament to your marriage and your relationship to each other, is giving each other that space and support. And as anyone trying to, you know, accomplish anything in life, is it's hard. I mean, people do it by themselves without support, but it really helps to have support, especially when you have a family involved, when you have children involved, because someone has to take care of them.
Thank you for that. And it wasn't always easy. You know, there's a shift in energy when the mom's the main caretaker of the household. And then dad comes home from work and, you know, he's a shift worker. So then the dynamic changes, daddy's home. And then to allow and trust Sean to manage things while I stepped away, you know, it required some shifting and acceptance, and it wasn't always smooth going, but we do our best. And when we don't, well, we learn from it.
Right. Any parting words of wisdom about confidence for burgeoning writers or just anyone wanting to pursue their passions?
Just make time for it, make space for it, hone it, because everything is a learning experience. This project has taught me so much about the craft of writing, about authorship, about entrepreneurship, about publication, about design, and all the in-between. There have been so many steps along the way. And I guess just honor your creative passion. Look for and be thankful for the support if you have it. Not everybody's so lucky. But if you can cultivate it, that's good, through writing groups or reading groups or dance groups. Because community makes the difference, validation, recognition, understanding, feedback, all of that matters. It's part of the package and the program that goes along with artistry and being an artist. So I'm thankful for the artists in this town and elsewhere who inspire me, because there's another great quote that is, it's not... Well, I can't get it exactly right, but something about life is not a support system for art. It's the other way around. Art is a support system for life.
Oh, yeah.
This is a quote by Stephen King from his memoir, On Writing.
Yeah, art is a support system for life. It helps us at times, especially through hard times like the pandemic. To listen to other people's wise words and to have those friends who, you know, send you just the right text at just the right time or what have you, it's meaningful and it's made a difference to me. And hopefully I can make even a small difference with readers.
Yeah. Well, I think you definitely will. And speaking of your book, so when is the book slated to come out, debut?
So hopefully, I'm thinking May, maybe for Mother's Day, a treat to myself and other mothers.
Okay, sounds good. Well, yeah, definitely let us know so that we can support you and put that blast out. So this will all be in the show notes, so you can learn more about Tamara, or as I know her, Tammy. You can follow her on Facebook, Despite the Buzz, and on Instagram, Tamara Miller Davis. And her book website is www.despitethebuzz.com. Thank you so much, Tammy, for being here today. This is her very first interview about her book. So I'm so excited and so honored that I could do this. And let's give her a big hug goodbye.
Thank you. It was an honor to be here. And I appreciate the other interviews that you've done. They've been inspiring to me. And how cool that we got to connect in this way.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And thank you all for listening today for this week. I will see you next time. This is The Confident Healer. My name is Sharmila Mali. Bye for now.
Want to know more about how to contact my guest? Then go to theconfidenthealer.net. This is also the best place to listen to the podcast. And while you're there, click subscribe to rate the show. Let's get those algorithms working to get this podcast to the masses. Thanks for listening and see you next time.